When we are talking about Old Testament history, why is the number 400 important? Ken? Increments. Somebody go farther with that. I have no doubt he knows exactly what he's talking about. What do the rest of you think? 400 is important because of increments. Yes. Old Testament history is easily remembered if you think of it as being comprised of 400-year cycles. Every 400 years, something big happened. And we start with the date 1800. 1800, what happened? The call of Abraham, 1800. Now, that's an approximation. I know that. But if you have the approximation, it's very helpful. It works. It falls in line. So 400 years later brings you down to 1400 B.C. What happens at approximately 1400 B.C.? In unison. Y'all know what in unison means? That means everybody at once. 1400 B.C., Moses brought the Israelites out of Egypt, the Exodus. 1800 B.C., the call of Abram. 1400 B.C., the Exodus. 1000 B.C., the beginning of the monarchy, kingdom. All of a sudden, it's a kingdom. And then 600 B.C., what happens? The Babylonian captivity. Now, this is why we say these are approximations, because we say 600, but the actual date is 586 B.C. But if you remember that number 400, it allows you just to get an idea of Old Testament history. It makes it very easy to remember. Now that brings us down to where we are in the present. 586 BC, the Babylonians destroyed the temple, took the Jewish nation into Babylonian captivity. Now we are down to 458 and 445. 458, Ezra returns, and then 445, Nehemiah returns and rebuilds the wall. Now, in all of this, we are really talking about the concept of restoration. And to us, sometimes we talk about restoration heritage. It has to be admitted that to us, the concept of restoration is tremendously important. And sometimes the restoration aspects of what are taking place here in Ezra and Nehemiah are just really kind of overlooked. We don't tend to think about it all that much in terms of restoration. Now, if we talk about what was restored, what has been restored up to this point? The Babylonians took them into captivity. Now, 70 years later, they are back, and really they've been in the land nearly 100 years now when you come down to 445. If we talk about what has been restored, their attitude has improved. Big example of that. Before going into captivity, they said, God's not fair. Now that they have come out of captivity, in Nehemiah 9 and verse 33, when they consider the actions of God over the course of their history, they say, you're just. They understand that God is fair. Their attitude is better. Excuse me. They've been restored to their land. They've rebuilt the temple. So they've got the land, they've got the temple, but there is one thing they do not have. And what is that? If we talk about restoration, there is one thing, their restoration will not be complete until it's there. They have to have, everybody turn to Ezekiel 37. Ezekiel prophesies as they are going into captivity. In Ezekiel 37, there were three things that Ezekiel mentioned. Now, he's on the backside of the captivity. Israel is being taken into captivity, but in the vision of the dry bones, God tells them that their hope is not lost because he's going to bring them back to the land. He is going to have a sanctuary. And what is a sanctuary? Give me another name for sanctuary. Temple. And then in verse 24, my servant David will be king over them. If you think about what they lost when they went into captivity, they lost their land, they lost their temple, they lost their king. For restoration to be complete, what do they have to have? Bring them back to their land, temple, and king. David will be their king. They are still waiting on that king, and they are going to wait for another 400 years. Now, so if somebody asks the question, we talk about restoration in Ezra and Nehemiah. Really, what is it that we are talking about restoring? The land, the temple, the king, the things that they had lost. Now, as we go farther, thinking about what we've been trying to get across here, in the last part of the book of Nehemiah, we have sort of the final picture of the Old Testament history of God's people. We're at the end of the road. There's going to be about a 400-year gap. Yes. I would appreciate it. Thank you. I thought I'd really messed up for a second. You're going like that. Thank you all. You might have to bear with me a little tonight. Have you all noticed at school that every other little kid you see is sick right now? Yeah. And those who work at school know how that affects the people that are there. Now, we are looking at the final picture of Old Testament history before we go into that 400-year period before the return of before Jesus comes. Now, in chapter 10, we were told that they were signing documents. And this document that they are signing to, talking about the final picture, in the 10th chapter, if you remember what we were looking at last week, we get a bunch of information. We tend to think, well, what's this all about? This is just details, details, details. Look at the big picture. Really what they are committing to is the maintenance of the temple. If you look at the 39th verse again, for the sons of Israel and the sons of Levi shall bring the contribution of the grain, the new wine and the oil to the chambers. There are the utensils of the sanctuary, the priests who are ministering, the gatekeepers and the singers. Thus we will not neglect the house of our God. There is a commitment there. They are not going to neglect the house of God. And we related that to ourselves. If we talk about God's temple today, based on what we see in Ephesians chapter 2, what is God's temple? The church. If we are thinking in terms of restoration, it takes a commitment of God's people to maintain the temple. There has to be this strong desire in the heart to say, it's going to be done like God wanted it done, and we're going to have that commitment. Now, with that in mind, let's go forward into chapter 11. And this one's funny. It's so simple. You think, well, why in the world would we bring it up? We need to bring it up because we need to fill out the picture. Chapter 11, verses 1 and 2. Bob Crow, would you read that? Okay, incredibly simple. What's going on in chapter 11? We're getting a commitment from some people to do what? Live in Jerusalem. Well, what's so big about living in Jerusalem? Who cares about repopulating it? Is Jerusalem a symbol? In the Jewish mind, is Jerusalem a symbol? Everybody turn to Psalm 122. In Psalm 122, we want to read the entire psalm. Paul Nerland, would you read that for us, please? Okay, just based on this psalm, can you see how Jerusalem is a symbol in the Jewish mind, what it stands for? Notice the fourth verse, to which the tribes go up, even the tribes of the Lord. They traveled to Jerusalem on a regular basis to worship God. In the fifth verse, for their thrones were set for judgment, thrones of the house of David. The ninth verse, for the sake of the house of the Lord our God, I will seek your good. In the Jewish mind, Jerusalem was important because it was the place where God had put his name. It's a symbol. Now, can you think, I don't mean this to be deep or difficult, but I probably won't get it across too well. Can you think of other cities that at one time or another really stood as symbols for something? Mecca, Babylon, Rome, in World War II. What was the Russian city that Hitler thought he had to take because of its symbolic value? Believe it or not, it was Stalingrad. Why Stalingrad? Because the name Stalin was in it, his arch enemy. There are times where the value of a city is not based on strategic value or anything else. It's symbolic value. Jerusalem had a symbolic value in the Jewish mind because it is the place where God put his name. And anybody that's wanting to conquer Israel, where do they have to end up? It's all going to end up where? Jerusalem. It's the place. So the walls have to be there, but if you get the walls up, nobody lives there, what have you accomplished? It's just not much of a symbol. So they have figured out that they have to populate Jerusalem. They have to get some people in that city, even if it has not much more than a symbolic value. Quick question. Would Jerusalem always have this symbolic significance to God's people? This is kind of a trick question. John 4, verses 21 through 23. Jesus said what to the woman at the well? The hour cometh when neither this mountain nor in Jerusalem. The hour comes when the true worshipers shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth. That was passing. That doesn't mean the Jewish nation was going to see it, because even to this day, in the minds of a lot of people, does Jerusalem have symbolic value? Do the people in Israel and the Muslims, any of them anxious to give that city up? No. Symbolic value. Now, to the Christian, there is a Jerusalem that's important, but the Hebrew writer calls it the heavenly Jerusalem, the city of the living God. Now, but for the present, for the time in which they are living, it's critical for them to maintain Jerusalem by making sure there are people there. Now, this what you might call a cheap point. We talked about maintaining the temple, related that to the church. If we take this second point, maintain Jerusalem, you got to have people in it if you want to maintain it. If we talk about the Lord's church as we see it here on earth, is it important to maintain people in it? If you talk about City of God or something that has a symbolic value, if you walk into a congregation that once had 200 people and you see 25, is that kind of a downer in your mind? A little bit. We know instinctively that the object is to do what? Grow, build up the city. That has a positive effect on the people who are in the city. And in our minds, that has a positive value in the cause of God. And the only thing we're trying to get across with that point is this. There are parallels between what they are trying to do here and what we are trying to accomplish today. We want to commit to maintain the temple. We want to commit to maintain Jerusalem. We want to see people there. Now let's go to chapter 12. In chapter 12 and verse 1. Now these are the priests and the Levites who came up with Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua, Seraiah, Jeremiah, Ezra. In verse 1, we are back to concentrating on the priest and the Levites. Now, if you're going to have a priesthood, what do the priests need to be able to do? All right, and this again is one of these passages as dull as dishwater. You know, when you sit here and you look at it and you say, why is it there? Why do we need to read it? What is there that's significant? If you're going to have restoration, and if you're going to have a functioning priesthood, what do the priests have to be able to do? Keep your finger there, and let's go back to Ezra chapter 2 for a moment. Ezra 2, verses 61 and 62. Mike Moon, would you read that, please? Okay. In order to be a priest, you had to be able to demonstrate what? Pardon me? Yeah, you had to show your pedigree. You had to show that you had the right to hold that office, and that was a big deal. Now, in Nehemiah 12, we read this, doesn't mean anything to us. But if you're one of them reading it back then, is it important to you? Because you've got to be able to demonstrate pedigree if you want to be a priest. Turn to Zechariah, book of Zechariah, chapter 3. This is a big issue at the return. Oh, and while you're turning there, something we just read. These are the priests and Levites who came up with Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua. That Jeshua, that's who we are reading about in Zechariah chapter 3. The prophet Zechariah has a vision. Then he showed me Joshua, the high priest, standing before the angel of the Lord, and Satan standing at his right hand to accuse him. In a vision, the prophet Zechariah sees the high priest. What kind of condition is the high priest in when you look at the third verse? What's he wearing? Filthy garments. What does that indicate? If it's a vision, if it's symbolic in nature, then what is the state of the priesthood when they first come back from Babylon? It's filthy. It's a question as to whether or not it can even function because it's filthy, it's unclean. They've been away from Jerusalem. They haven't been offering the sacrifices at the temple that they were supposed to offer. So can you even have a priesthood? If you look at the fifth verse, then I said, let them put a clean turban on his head. So they put a clean turban on his head and clothed him with garments while the angel of the Lord was standing by. In the vision, he sees the priest. He looks filthy. And all of a sudden, the voice says, clean him up. What does it indicate? From God's point of view, can the priesthood function? God decrees, yes, this priesthood is going to function. And it's interesting when we talk about this Jeshua or Joshua, the high priest, because you look down in the eighth verse, and you find out that this Joshua, the high priest, is a symbol for who? Somebody called the branch. If you know your Old Testament, you know that the branch is who? The branch is Jesus. Look that term up sometime in a concordance and see how many times that is used in Messianic prophecy. Now, let's go back to Nehemiah 12. Big issue when they came back from captivity as to whether they could have a functioning priesthood. There were some they couldn't find in the register, so they couldn't serve. The high priest, vision from God that he could function. And here, this is going to be all about establishing pedigree. If you look in verse 1 again, these are the priests and the Levites who came up with Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua. Right, that goes clear back to 536, and we're already down to 445. Why do we care? Why back up? We're talking pedigree here. That is the reason. Somebody's going to have to establish that they are able to function as a priest. When you drop down to the 10th verse, Jeshua became the father of Joachim. Joachim became the father of Eliashib. Eliashib became the father of Joiada. Joiada became the father of Jonathan. And Jonathan became the father of Jedua. Let me see if I can find what I'm looking for here. Ah, here we are. A list of the priests. When Zerubbabel comes back, Jeshua's the man, followed by Joachim, Eliashib, Joiada, Jonathan, Jedua. We are going down the list of the ones who took the position. Now, in verse 12, now in the days of Joachim, okay, so we've gone from Joshua to Joachim, and he's giving us a list of the priests here. Now, if you drop down to verse 22, you see what this really is all about. As for the Levites, the heads of fathers' households were registered in the days of Eliashib, Joiada, and Johanan, and Jedua. So were the priests in the reign of Darius the Persian. This is about registration. Now, we're not really concerned about all the names and all the details. We're just going to emphasize the fact that they are registered. You get them registered, and you can have a legitimate priesthood moving on. So we are coming to the end of Old Testament history as recorded in the Old Testament. And the last view that we are going to be seeing of them is getting things in place to move forward. They're pledging to maintain the temple, to maintain the Jerusalem. They're going to have a legitimate priesthood. Now, if you glance quickly at 27 through 47, end of the chapter, if you have read it, won't spend a lot of time talking about it. The dedication of the wall. They built the wall, they finished the wall, they're going to dedicate the wall. Now, can somebody briefly tell us how this is going to happen? Who are they going to gather in? And, all right, here's our bird's eye view of Jerusalem as it existed at that time. That's kind of what it looked like with temple right there. Rough outline. Real rough. What's going to happen at the... Okay, yeah, I know. If you look at this, at the dedication of the wall, what are the Levites going to do? Anybody read it? They're going to get all these singers together, and honestly, the way it is presented in Nehemiah, the singing service is a big deal. The king ordered it. They got all the Levites together to make this thing go. They said, we're really going to maintain this by paying all the tithes. This song service is a big deal to them. So evidently, there had been a lapse in it for a long time. On the day that they dedicate the wall, and I don't know exactly where they started, they're going to take all the singers, and they're going to break them into two groups. One of them is going to go to the left. One of them is going to go to the right. They're going to march around the walls and then meet at the temple. I don't know if they were singing all the way. I tend to think that they probably were. But the two groups were going in separate directions, and then they would meet at the in the middle of the temple. If you look at verse 31... Then I had the leaders of Judah come up on top of the wall, and I appointed two great choirs, the first proceeding to the right on top of the wall toward the refuse gate. So one takes off, walking on the wall toward the refuse gate, and in verse 38, the second choir proceeded to the left. All right, so one's going the other way, and they are going to meet here in the middle. And on the big day, verse 43, on that day they offered great sacrifices and rejoiced because God had given them great joy. Even the women and children rejoiced so that the joy of Jerusalem was heard from afar. It's a big day. So here's what we have. Final picture. They maintain the temple. They maintain Jerusalem. They have a legitimate priesthood, and included in this is the song service as was directed by David. And it's going to be an ongoing thing. If you look at verses 44 through 47, they were going to collect the tithe. They were going to make sure this service was maintained. Now, that brings us to chapter 13. The final look, vigilance and detail. That's what we're going to get out of chapter 13 in Nehemiah. Now, again, I'm not claiming that this is all that deep, but you just think of these concepts when you're thinking about restoration. What does it mean to have restoration? Restoration is when you commit to maintain the temple as God directed. Restoration is when you maintain Jerusalem. You're interested in seeing people there. Restoration is when you have a legitimate functioning priesthood. And by the way, if we talk about the legitimate functioning priesthood in the New Testament church, what are we talking about? Who would that be? Who are the priests in the New Testament church? Jesus is high priest. Revelation 1 and verse 6. You are a kingdom of priests. One of the doctrines of Catholicism, you need a priest to stand between you and God. Does the New Testament teach that I need another man to function as priest for me? Doctrine, priesthood of all believers, priesthood of all Christians. So if we talk about restoration, again, this is what we're talking about, maintaining the temple, maintaining people in Jerusalem, a functioning priesthood, and then finally, vigilance in the details. Is it possible, y'all get ready to talk, is it possible to have all the big things in place and lose it over small details? Somebody give me a verse in the New Testament that emphasizes the importance of small details. Would you say that again? Building the ark. There's a lot of detail there, but let's take it over to the New Testament for a second. I'll give you one illustration. 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 6, a little leaven leaveneth the whole lump. What do you get from that? I'll ask for a volunteer, Gary. A little leaven leaveneth the whole lump. It grows. You know, that is a very simple point in 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 6. A little leaven leaveneth the whole lump. Does experience bear that out? I mean, if you started in 2017 and just started backing up, would you have to go back too many years to find examples of that? Vigilance matters. Let's go to Luke 16 and verse 10. In Luke 16 and verse 10, he who is faithful in a very little thing is faithful also in much. And he who is unrighteous in a very little thing is unrighteous also in much. Now, what do we learn about very little things? Do very little things, even if we might want to overlook them like they really don't matter, do very little things say a lot about a person's attitude and the direction he's going to go in the future? Little things matter. And that's why vigilance in detail matters. Now, with that in mind, let's go back to Nehemiah 13. It's kind of funny, you know, if you look at something as being, you know, symbolic or prophetic. You know, we start out chapters 10, 11, and 12, big things. I mean, it is huge, the idea of committing to maintain the temple. We want God's temple to be what God intended it to be. And it is a big thing to say the city of God is going to have people in it. And it is a big thing to say we're going to have a legitimate functioning priesthood, which is just another way of saying Christians are going to be what they need to be. And then you get to that 13th chapter and it almost looks like it's out of place. You know, but what you can really see here is you get all the big things lined up and you still have to continue to be vigilant or things will go to pot. Let's look at the first three verses of the 13th chapter. John Kent, would you read that, please?
Curse into a blessing. So it was when they heard the law that they
Okay, you notice in these first three verses, there is a need to exclude foreigners. Now, they read in the law that Moabites and Ammonites were not to enter the assembly. Anybody know where that is? Keep your finger there and go to Deuteronomy 23. Deuteronomy 23, verses 3 through 5. No Ammonite or Moabite shall enter the assembly of the Lord. None of their descendants, even to the tenth generation, shall ever enter the assembly of the Lord, because they did not meet you with food and water on the way when you came out of Egypt, and because they hired against you Balaam the son of Beor, from Pethor, Mesopotamia, to curse you. Nevertheless, the Lord your God was not willing to listen to Balaam, but the Lord your God turned the curse into a blessing for you, because the Lord your God loves you. All right, a simple law. Moabites and the Ammonites are not going to enter into the assembly. So we come back over here. Excuse me. In Nehemiah 13. And when you look at that third verse, Nehemiah 13, how does it look like they applied that? Could be wrong about this, but it looked like they did what? We're just going to exclude all foreigners. Maybe that's it. Maybe all foreigners there just meant all foreigners of the Ammonites and the Moabites. But we have already seen over and over in Ezra and Nehemiah, as far back as the days of Ezra, we want to help you build. What did they tell them? No. In the days of Nehemiah, same issue. No, you guys have no part in this. And that's still the way it is. Now, the only thing I could think of to relate this to, if you're trying to bring ideas over into the New Testament that we can relate to, just concepts of fellowship. I mean, are you in fellowship with everybody? I mean, are there those today that the people of God really are not in fellowship with? They are not of us? You know, what concord has Christ with Belial? These kinds of things are always present with the people of God. And the reason this particular incident is so important, it really links with what we see in verses 4 through 9 about Tobiah the Ammonite. All right, let's take a moment and read that. Brian, would you read Nehemiah 13, verses 4 through 9? Okay, here we are talking about Tobiah. Of what nation is he? Anybody remember? From chapter 2 and verse 10, he was in league with Sanballat, and he is called Tobiah the... He's an Ammonite. The first three verses, no Moabites, no Ammonites, and when we get to verses 4 through 9, we find Tobiah actually has a room where... In the temple. They have turned the temple into a Motel 6. When you look at verses 4 and 5, Eliashib the priest had prepared a large room for him where formerly they'd done what? A storeroom where they had kept what? Offerings and stuff that was needed for the maintenance of the temple. Our storeroom will take and throw all this stuff out of here so we can make a room for my relative Tobiah the Ammonite. Now, Eliashib is the priest at this time, and he is related to Tobiah. Anybody want to make just a comment about doing things to make relatives happy? How many times in the Bible, and this isn't all that often, where people were displeasing to God so they could placate a relative? Solomon, big example. Y'all remember Eli? What was his big problem? Hophni and Phinehas, his sons. Anybody want to venture why Adam ate the fruit? Maybe to make his wife happy? A lot of examples in the biblical text about people doing things to make relatives happy that they should not have done. And this is another example. Eliashib the priest clears out a room in the temple so that his Ammonite relative can have a place to stay at the temple. Now, what's the problem with this? Pardon me? You got an Ammonite in the temple, defiles the temple. Now, wait a minute. Did anybody live at the temple? Did anybody live at the temple? How many of you have never thought of that question before today? Did anybody live at the temple? Let's look at a couple of passages. Let's go to 1 Chronicles 9. First Chronicles 9 and verse 33. Now these are the singers, heads of fathers' households of the Levites, who lived in the chambers of the temple, free from other service, for they were engaged in their work day and night. Let's back up to the 26th verse. For the four chief gatekeepers who were Levites were in an office of trust and were over the chambers and over the treasuries in the house of God. They spent the night around the house of God because the watch was committed to them and they were in charge of opening it morning by morning. Now, it does seem that there were those who lived in the chambers of the house of God, but the Ammonites weren't included in that number. Now, Eliashib seemed to think that I can take this temple and do anything I want to with it. He couldn't. This is an example of, you have a structure here that, put it in our terms today, it is built for one purpose and somebody uses it for another purpose and it was not justified. So he comes back and throws everything out of it. Now, here's a question. We'll leave it with this. Tobiah was an Ammonite. Well, what if it was just regular run-of-the-mill Israelite? Could he? Could they, you know, take a chamber, clean it out for him, and say, okay, you can live here? We'll pick up there next week.